hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Dr. Tom Ingenio is a doctor of acupuncture and Chinese medicine, integrative health specialist, and founder of Charm City Integrative Health, a multifaceted clinic that NYT bestseller and futurist David Houle called the future of medicine. With well worth over two decades of experience and a litany of awards, Dr. Tom aims to make health accessible to all. Beyond his success inside his clinic, he is a featured healthcare expert, holistic health trailblazer, and author. As a practitioner, Dr. Tom combines traditional modalities with cutting-edge therapies to help reduce inflammation. His mission lies in preventing or providing treatment that is aimed not only at alleviating symptoms, but improving his patient's overall quality of life. His passion has led him to many accomplishments, such as being the chair of the Maryland State Board of Acupuncture, adjunct professor at Elite Oriental Medicine Institutions, former director of acupuncture for a chain of wellness centers, and author of You Got Sick, Now What? And The Cupping Book. When not practicing, Dr. Tom may be found lifting kettlebells, meditating, or spending time with his wife and two daughters. Dr. Tom Ingenio, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
Wow, Casey. First of all, I don't know who wrote that intro for me, but I gotta give him a raise. That makes me sound so impressive. Thank you so much for having me.
Very impressive. Like all of our guests, I offer this at any point. If you want me to just reread at any point of our conversation, you just stop me at any time and let me know. We'll do it again. We're all about boosting the self-esteem here. You know what I mean?
I got you, man. I don't. The ego gets any bigger, I won't be able to wear hats anymore, you know?
That's amazing. Well, you might not believe this, but that was actually very much abbreviated. I didn't say anything about the podcast that you have. Is it called Irreverent Health?
Yeah, yes, it is. You know, a buddy of mine, Matt Hampton, and I were having these conversations. We're both part of this business group, and we met through a guy named Joe McClinsky, who's absolutely a juggernaut, great guy. He's a business consultant, and you know, he gave one of the most viewed TED talks. But he somehow collected this group of people that were just a little bit out there, a little bit different. And Matt and I came aboard in that group about the same time. And it turned out that every time we met up, we'd have like an hour and a half conversation of some weird health topics. And at one point, you know, COVID hit and we're all kind of sitting around and we're like, you just want to start recording this? And that's kind of where it came from. And, you know, Matt comes from, he's got a graphic design degree. So he's really in the internet side of it. He's really into AI. And when we look at things, we want to look at things that are a little bit more out there. So we end up talking a lot about AI and psychedelics and these things and that convergence with healthcare, right? So we love talking to people that do something that's a little bit out there. And, you know, I know we were talking prior to your about your wife and her technique. We'd love to talk to her probably. So we'll set that up after. But it's all about, you know, what can we do to improve the quality of our lives, right? I kind of am leaning away from the biohacking term these days. And that's for some personal reasons, as well as I think there's a little bit of a lack of awareness when it comes to community health or public health. The mentality is a little bit more, well, I'm going to be okay, so F all of you. And I think that's a fault because it, you know, you exist in a community, you exist in a society. If you want to go live in the woods by yourself, yeah, fine, do whatever the hell you want. And I don't want to tell anybody what to do at the same time, which is kind of a weird conundrum. But within that, how can we optimize our lifestyles, right? East Asian medicine is huge in that. We call that yang shen. That's like, you know, nourishing life is how we translate it. So how do we have the fullest life? And it's not, it's not all cocaine and partying all the time. It's how do we have that rich, full life that's balanced?
Yeah.
You know, so when we see that, when biohacking first arrived on the scene, I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. And now I'm like, it's got some benefits, it got some uses, but how do we fit that into the average person's life that exists in modern America, right? You know, some of these bigger names, they'll go out and drop, well, they're not dropping it, they're getting the free services, but they're getting stem cells every 6 months. And you're like, okay, so that's $30,000. And, oh, I got this brain mapping done. Oh, that's $40,000. And you're like, okay, first of all, in the last week, you spent 40 hours alone doing something for your health. And that's out of reach for most of us, right? You know, I got to work. So how do we do the things that are most impactful, the most cost effective, and, you know, allow us to live in our lives? And for me, stuff like cupping therapy was one of those things, which is why I wrote the book, right? You know, the idea was, how do we bring this a little bit more mainstream? It's already been mainstream. It's 5,000 years old. It didn't need me. But can we put a voice to it? Can we get it in people's hands?
Yeah, man, I love that. So I do love the podcast. I love all of that. I didn't know cupping was as ancient as it was. It's something that my wife does around here with herself and some of her, you know, the people that she sees. So I've been aware of it, but I'm excited to ask you a bunch of questions about it. We'll get there in a second. As we were talking offline, you're talking to largely an audience that is following unconventional advice as it pertains to nutrition. There's a lot of people that have followed, you know, the traditional modalities and the food pyramid, and they got very sick, some of them with very serious chronic disease.
And found
that the more they tried to follow that, the worse they got. The more they went opposite of that and tried, you know, low carbohydrate, high fat, even carnivore diets, that they experienced incredible improvement. And so it's an audience that is like, they understand the importance of Western medicine and medical care for acute care, but they don't really see a lot of necessity for chronic care. And this is where I think you come in, and where all these different modalities that you're talking about are quite interesting, and people are into that kind of stuff. We just don't know where to kind of like draw the line. You know what I mean? Like, when is it too much?
Exactly. And I got to be honest, you know, if you look at some of the services we have at our clinic, right, we do cryotherapy, we have the cold plunges, we have the sauna, we have red light therapy, we have salt therapy. All of those things, they sound so like, you know, faddish, right? Oh, this is the new thing coming out, right? But as we look at the research, we're like, some of these things are 40 years old at least. Red light therapy has been around that long. Cryotherapy has been around that long. You know, even things like salt therapy, God, you know, there was a mine in Poland that a doctor was sending people into. It was a salt mine for respiratory disorders, right? We've known about these therapies for thousands of years in some cases. It's just that they've gotten modern medicine, gotten some modern research behind them, I should say. Now, the same thing with diet, right? We're not eating anything like we did in the 50s or the 40s. You know, it's not even that long ago, right? I also feel like this here in the US, we have this such unique position where we have genetics that are so mixed and so different, right? This one size fits all medicine was never meant to work. And this idea, I remember, like, you know, there was a time when, like, oh, you gave the baby formula, right? Why? Because that's science, right? It's like, well, but that's going to do it better. And look, if you can't breastfeed or don't, this is not, I'm not shaming you, do what you need to do. But at the same time, it's like, well, why would your body not make the thing that the baby needs? And why would that not be as good as something that came out of a can, if not better? Right. So I like the fact that we're starting to explore that. I like the fact that we're seeing all this information. For me, the scary thing is sometimes it moves so quick that, like, we're on something and we're like, oh, wait, maybe this isn't as good, right? And you know, even the GLP-1s, right, the semaglutides and stuff like that, I'm like, oh, I'll play with that. And I'm like, why am I getting heartburn after I inject myself and I can't lay down? Okay, maybe this isn't everything it's supposed to be, right? So on one hand, I fully love when people self-experiment, because, right, when we talk about public health, we want that N to be the largest possible number, so we know how many people might get hurt and how much it's going to help people. But when it comes down to our individual selves, that N is always going to be one. And who cares? You know, like, you know, if you're the guy that does really well with a certain drug, great. But if you're the guy that takes like a drop of it and it kills you, well, we don't care about the other guy, right? You know, that's going to kill me. So it, being able to dial in your own specific health is really important. Now we need the guidelines of what it is to be a normal human and what's safe in those parameters. And the technology is coming out so quick that, like, we're learning more every day. We're adding new drugs every day. We're adding new techniques every day, which is, you know, it's kind of a great time to be alive. But where is the real good stuff, and where is the maybe showmanship That's going to take a little while to suss out, you know? So I'm a huge fan of people trying things out. I also want to have some time tested theories and some good research to back it up, you know?
Yep. Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And a lot of what we call hacking, biohacking, I'm kind of with you. Like when it first came out, it was like, oh, this is really great. All of these
things. This is really cool. Yeah.
It just keeps going. And all of a sudden it's like these protocols. It seems like they're days or weeks long to be able to complete. And look, I'm sitting here, yeah. I'm talking to you through a screen. I'm sitting on my grounding mat. I've got my toe spacers. I've got a red light. All of this is like fine. It's good. I would much rather be out in the sunshine
outside, yeah.
with you in person, throwing kettlebells around or walking around barefoot.
Yeah.
Some of these techniques that you're talking about, they're just replacing what our normal lives would have already been.
I've said that so much. And it's very funny because literally my red light is right there. The grounding mat is on the floor. I've got an infrared sauna over here. I could probably reach my blue light glasses. And I've got like 15 other little biohacking devices. And if we were just outside getting exposed to the elements, walking around more, you're absolutely right. Half of my services at my clinic would go out the window.
Yep.
And I tell people that. I'm like, that's not a good business model, but who's going to go out and walk around the park at barefoot, you know,
right.
like in October or something, you know? You're not going to do it.
Yep.
Okay, come in. Jump in the tub.
Love that. Yeah, I absolutely love that. Let's start with your kind of story. How did you get interested in some of this stuff? And how were you able to kind of mash together Eastern understanding with Western understanding? Because you're really yeah. not firmly planted in either one.
I keep giving my creation story, but you know, like I was told that, you know, like from a young age, hey, you want to help people, you go be a doctor, right? So I was all set up to be an MD. And through a couple of weird experiences, like, you know, waiting at a doctor's office and the doctor wasn't even there. And it's 2 hours after I was there, there's a waiting room full of people. And well, when will she be here? Oh, she's in surgery now. Well, why the hell would you make an 8 a.m. appointment for me? It's already 10. So I walked out of there with a bad taste in my mouth. You know, I had a couple of people say, oh, this is wrong with you or that's wrong with you. Let's do this. And I was like, no, that's not what I told you, you know, and that's not what your blood work is showing either. So I was firmly aware that I didn't want to just go the route where you were kind of cattle called through and just like, oh, you got 8 minutes with this doc, get going. Because I do think healthcare has to have a very human component, a very like, I want to be able to trust the person, right? I would rather have them walk out and say, look, I got to look that up. I don't know that. Give me a second. Rather than have, you know, a kind of computer-like memory, but not be able to understand how I'm feeling with my specific issues, right? You know, so that compassion, that humanity has been bred out of Western medicine. And I don't believe it's the practitioner's fault, right? I think that's more of the system, right? Oh, we got to have this high volume thing. We got to keep the wheels churning. You got to keep the insurance companies happy, the drug companies happy, da, 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 da. And that's all about money, not about patient care. So a Chinese philosophy class had me looking a little bit differently. Oddly enough, my mother, God, this is such a weird story. My mother used to do raffles for the high school I went to, right? So I was in college and she was still doing the raffles because my younger brother was still in high school. And I go downstairs and there's just boxes of stuff people donated. Well, sitting on the top of a box of books was a book called Opening the Dragon Gate, right? And I'd done some Tai Chi classes. I'd taken the Chinese philosophy class and I'm like, what's this, right? So it was a story about a small Taoist sect and real weird. It was like relatively, I think it was like right before the Communist Revolution or around that time. And the story of this kid being chosen as like a reincarnated Taoist priest.
Wow.
And, you know, they do this a whole bunch of weird, really esoteric stuff. I'm not sure how true any of that is, but they even treat with acupuncture somebody's shadow. They put the needles in the guy's in the ground in the shadow of the guy, and the guy like leans over and throws up, and suddenly he's wow. cured. You know that one of the older priests. The whole town is sick, so they meet in this like, well, it's not a church, but in the same kind of like the town gathering building. They shut all the blinds and everything, and he puts a needle in the ground, and everybody starts vomiting, and they all feel better. And I went, well, this is super weird. Let me look into it a little bit more. And oddly enough, the intercession between, you know, first and second semester of my junior year, I got a postcard in the mail from an acupuncture school. And before I went back from winter break, I was signed up for the acupuncture program. And I kind of never looked back from there. That was a long, long, long way around there, but.
That's very interesting. You mentioned something about the medical doctor knowing everything. I'm probably going to butcher this. This was just an interview I did yesterday where the guy who I was interviewing, his dad was a medical doctor. And he said, again, I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to butcher this, but he said, basically, if you're a lawyer, you'll make more money if you hear somebody out and then reach for a book to look something up. And as a medical doctor, you'll make less money if somebody tells you something and you reach back for a book to open it up. Like you expect.
Well, it's probably time-based. Yeah.
Right. And like you expect the medical doctor to, like you said, just have this like computer memory of all this stuff, and if he has to look something up, yeah, you think, oh, this guy's an idiot.
Well, yeah, you know, that's funny because the expression is, and it's not a very common one, the first time I heard it I'm like, is that a real expression, is old lawyer, young doctor. Right, because laws rarely change, the system that we practice law in remains relatively the same. But doctors, like, they know, they graduate from med school and within 6 months 50% of what they've learned is already outdated.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's so many. And speaking of like the biohacking movement, there was a Greek physician, I forget his last name. And he started doing these lectures where he was talking about like, hey, these statins are horrible for you. And all of these myths that are still in modern medicine today. And this is probably about a decade or two ago. He's doing this lecture and he's saying, look, this is wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. And he's expecting, you know, a whole audience of medical doctors to get up there and hang him publicly. And they all went, yeah, I can see that. But yet the system hasn't changed, right? He's written books and articles on the topic. Like, why are we still doing this? You know, we have medicine moving at, you know, a rocket pace, but the way we change how we practice it isn't catching up. And I think that's very interesting. And one of the biggest things I've noticed in relating this back to East Asian medicine is when I started, I actually had a physician tell a patient that I was going to give him hepatitis if he saw me.
Wow.
Somehow I was going to use dirty needles or, you know, and now I'm lecturing to med students at University of Maryland. Well, why? Because they know here's my lane. You know, they might be the quarterback, you know, they might, you know, but when it's outside of here, well, we can't give opioids like we used to. So what are we going to do for pain? Well, what's the best research? Oh, it's acupuncture. Oh, when we need to modify somebody's lifestyle, we need to deal with their emotional stuff. When we need to look at the body as a whole system, who does that? Oh, East Asian medicine does. Right. So we're starting to take the role of what I think healthcare really should be, which is well care, right? Casey, if you come in and you're hit by a bus, it's not going to be much I can do for you until you know the bleeding stop and the bones are set and all that stuff. But afterwards, how do we recover? Okay, but you know, maybe you got hit by the bus because you were so stressed out, you weren't looking, you weren't sleeping, you know, all these things. Well, what if I treated you before then? Now it's a big jump, it's a leap of faith to say that like, if you were in a better headspace, you were able to pay more attention, maybe you wouldn't got in front of that bus, right? But that's really what we're trying to do with East Asian medicine, is get you up and running and keep your body, mind, all of it connected and grounded and operating the way it's supposed to, so those things don't happen.
Yeah.
Right? You know, we have cancer cells in our body all the time. When does it hit? When our body is dysregulated. You know, normally we can take care of it.
Yep. Well, that's a really good segue. I wanted to ask you about your first book. You got sick. Now what? You wrote that book in 2011. I presume you did not know anything about a COVID pandemic that was right around the corner, just a decade around the corner.
You know, it was so funny. And I'm going to be completely candid with this. I wrote the book because I was offered an interview on a major TV network. And I'm like, wow, this is great. This'll make me, you know. And we got to like the final, like, let's book the date and everything and say, okay, so what have you written? And I started listing off, you know, professional journals that I've been published in. And they're like, no. Do you have a book? And I go, no. They were like, we can't use you. And I went, but here's my pedigree. Here's everything I've done. They're like, yeah, but you got nothing. You got nothing for the public to pick up.
Wow.
So I wrote that book going like, well, what would be an easy purview of like a larger selection of services from East Asian medicine that people could do at home. Yeah. So, you know, the idea was, at some point, somebody's going to get a cold or a flu and they're going to feel like crap. And what happens if you read the book? And when I say book, I think it's 80 pages. It's not really a heavy read. But the idea is, what is simple? What can you have on hand at home? And how can you pick up a quick book and have a reference? Oh, here's the soup I can make. Oh, here's what gua sha looks like. I do talk about fire cupping in it. I've backed off. I'm not as cavalier anymore. The cupping book talks more about how to do home cupping with silicone cups or pumps or things like that. We talk about exercises, qigong, for kind of getting the body core temperature up, and just some kind of old sagely advice that kind of is in that East Asian medicine world for helping people recover.
Yeah, well, no, and that's great. And that's on the recovery side of things. But the point of like what you were saying as far as like you got hit by the bus because you weren't paying attention to all those other things. You weren't taking care of your sleep and your nutrition and your health and exercising. I when everything started shutting down, I kind of made this post on social media that was like, look, this is why we were telling you guys, you need to sort this stuff out because at this point, we've got this thing that's coming around and it's going to hit people harder if you haven't been taking care of yourself. Like there's things that you can do to recover in your book, but there's also all of those things that you can do for preventative care. And that's why I love how you approach this. And so on that note, I want to talk about acupuncture in particular. And just pretend that I know nothing about acupuncture, save that I saw a picture of it and there's a dude on a table and there's a bunch of needles sticking out of him. And I think to myself, okay, I don't like needles. So that doesn't look like any fun at all. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm.
This is the number one. I was actually, I was flipping through YouTube and found a TED talk that somebody did who's got a mobile bus in Idaho or Iowa or something. And he does acupuncture out of that. And, you know, he said the first question is, does it hurt? You know, and I think that's pretty universal. And, you know, we're talking about a very different type of needle. And it's so weird. I almost don't even like talking about the needles because there is this mental component for a lot of people. But the design of these needles, it is not a syringe, right? It's not designed to penetrate the skin, create a pouch to then inject something or pull something out, right? So a syringe comes to a blade. The edge looks like a knife. These needles are designed more like, sometimes they'll call it a pine cone tip, where it's trying to push the tissue out of the way. We're also talking about the average size of a needle being 0.18 millimeters wide. So 18 hundredths of a millimeter wide, which is roughly 3 strands of hair. Well, you know, I can't have a reference guide right now, but at one point I did. Within that, it's really meant to go into the tissue with causing the least amount of stimulation, tissue disruption. And what that triggers is a systemic response. In Japan, they call this an artificial splinter, affectionately, right? Something is now in my body and my body has a response to that. And what is that response? Well, it sends fresh blood to that area. It sends nutrients, oxygen, antibodies, white blood cells. And it goes, okay, well, we're here now. What do we need to repair? Well, this little sterile needle really didn't do any damage. But while we're here, oh, look, these muscles are tight. Oh, well, while we're here, let's like open up the chest. Let's relax the breathing. Let's do all these things with all this fresh blood, extra oxygen, extra nutrients that we have. So it's really a unique system that has multiple functions. This artificial splinter function is only one of them. A big overarching effect that we see, regardless of what we're treating, is regulation of the autonomic nervous system. Right. So that this is the idea of getting you out of fight or flight and putting you into rest and digest. Right. And as many studies as we have, we see it happening time and time again. We don't know exactly why from a Western standpoint. And the classical explanation is we've smoothed the flow of qi and the body's at rest. and that's the only one that we can really hang on to right now, because we see that switch flip. Right. We get out of fight or flight. We go into rest and digest at about 10 to 15 minutes into the acupuncture session. All the blood vessels open up. So now we're getting better blood flow through all the tissues. So whether it's an injury where something's inflamed, we can flush out the cytokines, the inflammatory markers, lactic acid, whatever it is. We get fresh blood in to help repair it. Now, what happens in rest and digest to our gut, right? We're getting more blood flow to the gut. We're picking up more nutrients. We're also reducing inflammation in the gut. We're opening up the chest so we can breathe deeper. Our heart pumps slower, but expands and contracts more. So we're pumping blood more effectively. So we switched ourselves into that repair mode. And then those artificial splinters are there to direct that blood flow where it needs to go. Classically, we have one line that says, where the chi goes, the blood follows. And it's almost like they're copping out. They're saying, like, get blood there and we'll see an improvement, right? So we can't tell the body to, hey, fix this or do that. But what we can do is give it the signals that this area needs attention, or, hey, we need to put you in repair mode so you can deal with this.
That was just about the best explanation of acupuncture that I have ever heard. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. Pain, I would assume, would be the number one reason that people would think about acupuncture.
Yeah.
Is that true? And if so, what are some of the other like benefits or lesser known things that people use acupuncture for?
Certainly when I started out, it was like 80% low back pain. Some days I long for those days because now like I had somebody go, I must be the most complicated case you have. And I go, yeah, you're the third most complicated case I've had. And I've only been here 2 hours today. so what we end up doing really well with, and this is not curing, this is not fixing. We do well with chronic inflammatory disorders, autoimmune disorders, these things, right? They're very difficult to treat. But what ends up happening is they'll exhaust the entire Western medical system. Oh, the GI guy says it's this, and this person says it's this, and this person says it's this. And it's really their whole system is not in harmony, and it's attacking itself. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. There's genetic reasons, there's exposure, toxicity reasons, there's chronic infection reasons. And Western medicine, if they can't cut it out, if they can't give a drug to knock it down, in these kind of cases, they're kind of at a loss. Now, what we end up doing is we work with a lot of people that are on a lot of meds, but we're trying to help their system regulate better. So autoimmune disorders is probably the number one thing I'm seeing in my clinic. Now, my clinic sees a lot of mental health stuff, anxiety, depression, generalized stress disorders, PTSD. We're coming into spring, so I know I'm going to have a huge rush of allergy, asthma patients. And physical pain still is up there. I mean, if you look at our clinic, a lot of the stuff we do can really help relieve pain, not just the acupuncture, but cupping's known for that as well. Therapeutic massage, cryotherapy, cold plunges, sauna, red light, all of it helps with pain, but it's really, when we're aiming, it's aiming at inflammation. Can we reduce inflammation? Because even autoimmune disorders, a lot of the issues are because the autoimmune disorder is causing inflammation.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. So as a practitioner, are you following specific protocols? Like, do you know, if this person says, I'm dealing with this, am I putting 17 needles in this order in this way, or is there a lot more art to it?
So, when I was teaching and when I was a student, everyone wanted a protocol for everything, right? And there's some really cool protocols. The problem is, acupuncture has this history, and the more we're learning, because now we're still finding texts, right? We're finding texts that exist before the Yellow Emperor's Internal Classics, which is our, I don't want to use the word Bible and give it a religious spin, but that's our text, right? That is the one we base the whole modern system of acupuncture off of, and we do neoclassical versions of that, and I'm sure some scholar's going to bang me for saying that. But we have texts that go back even earlier than that, where we still have the channels on the body, but they don't have any points on them. Or there aren't 12 channels, there's only 9 on this one. Okay, and they don't run exactly the same. So acupuncture as a practice has evolved. Now, the classical one from that Yellow Emperor is the Ling Shu, the spiritual pivot. It says check everywhere. So here's the channels, but I got to check all the points. Now, we do have points post 1950, and people are going to yell at me for the years and things like this, but loosely then, they started to combine Chinese herbal medicine with acupuncture. Practitioners always use them together, but acupuncture was a little bit more free form. It's a body work thing. I'm going to put my hands on you. Oh, this one hurts? Yeah, that's the one I want to choose. Well, they started to give the points herbal properties, right? So we go, oh, well, this one drains damp, and this one does this, and this one does that. And we have plenty of people using acupuncture like that. They're getting successful results, and they like protocols. I practice a system, which is, like, once again, a neoclassical system called Japanese Meridian Therapy. So I want to figure out which channels are most involved and then feel those channels. Now, the funny thing is, I'll choose a point because the patient said, ow, and I'm like, oh, I feel this great little knot there, or there's a depression here. And you go look at the textbook, and half the complaints that the patient had are listed for that point.
Wow.
So, you know, all roads lead to Rome, but I don't use point prescriptions unless the patient is saying the things that that protocol specifically calls for.
Interesting.
Right. It's you don't take the patient and jam them into the protocol. The protocol fits the patient. But other than that, it's a little bit more free form. I was at a lecture with a guy. He's 96. I think he's still treating a little bit.
Wow.
And he's hysterical. He's this old little Japanese man who he does a technique called super superficial, where he rotates the needle just touching the skin. It might go in a millimeter. And he's been clocked at like 600 rotations per minute or something by a college in Japan. But you know, he's doing this demo and he goes, okay, so the classical point selection using this theory is this, this, and this. And he, not only did he not use those points, he didn't even use those channels. And then somebody raised their hand and they're like, you said you were going to do this and this, and you didn't do it. He goes, yeah, I didn't feel like it. So, you know, like if we're composing a symphony, it's a little bit more maybe jazz, maybe yeah. A little bit more freeform jazz.
Gotcha. That is very interesting. I appreciate all of that. And I realize, obviously, to do acupuncture, you need to find a practitioner to be able to do that and find a very good qualified one. You wrote the book on cupping, which is now a different kind of technique that people can have done for them, or they could do it on their own. So tell us a little bit about cupping. First of all, what it is, why you decided to write a book about it, and we'll get into some of the details.
Yeah. So cupping therapy is actually older than a formalized acupuncture system. Now, there might have been some needle therapy done back then too, but we don't have anything written down. The first references that we can find are either from Persia, Greece, or Egypt. So the Ebers Papyrus, which is a medical text that dates 1515 BC, details a lot about cupping. And what it was basically used for, it's creating suction, and traditionally it's fire to eat the oxygen out of a jar to create this suction and pull the skin away from the fascia away from the muscles, and create this void where blood can be pulled into. You know, so basically we're flushing tissue out that's a little bit deeper and causing a bruise at the surface by breaking those capillaries at the surface, but separating that tissue to give some space for fresh blood to come in and circulate through. You know, it is amazing to me because even from a Chinese tradition, at about 300 AD, there was a physician called Ge Hong, and he's done so much crazy stuff. He's a legend. But he wrote in a textbook, like, look, we call this folk medicine, you know, because back then they were physicians. They were busy doing surgery and heavy duty things. They didn't want to bother themselves with the stuff, you know, your grandmothers were doing at home. He goes, but this is really effective. We should be using this. And I'm paraphrasing that. Chinese don't talk like that. Don't bang me for that. But within that, Chinese practitioners started using it in their clinics. Before that, and it's affectionately referred to as grandma medicine by a lot of cultures. The other reason I like it is because it is worldwide. There isn't a culture. When I was teaching at Pacific College in Oriental Medicine in New York, they had a lot of international students. Didn't matter where they were from. Africa, Europe, Russia, Asia, South America. everybody said grandma used to do that, right? And there's a scene in The Godfather Part Two where they treat Fredo as a baby. The grandma treats him on the kitchen table with a cup and puts it on his chest.
Wow,
right?
I forgot about that.
Zorba the Greek was from like 1960 something. And there's a scene where there's cupping involved, right? So this is something that I really liked because one, it's a traditionally practiced therapy in people's houses, right? So let's put it back into the hands of the people. Two, it didn't have like a cultural barrier. It didn't feel like appropriation, right? Everybody has this in their history. And one of the great things when I was teaching at that school was like, hey, you know, in Italy, my grandmother used to do this. She used to put down a coin. She'd take a little piece of cotton and some brandy. She'd light the brandy on fire, throw the cup over. Oh, you know, somebody in Syria goes, oh, they make the cups longer there. So you roll up a little piece of newspaper, you light the end, you throw it in, you put the cup on, the fire never touches the patient. You know, so there's a whole bunch of different ways to get the reaction. And that developed a little bit independently, but the theory is still the same. You know, this is how we do this. Even in the Islamic faith, they call it hijama. It's written about in the Quran. It's referenced by the Prophet Muhammad several times. And even like, so their holy days of obligation, they have about three a month that are supposed to be good to go get cupping therapy done.
Wow.
So it has this rich history across the globe. Even oddly enough, even South America, before we know that there was a connection to the Western part of the world or the, you know, the Eastern part of the world, they called it Ventosa. They knew about it. They were doing it. So it's really kind of crazy. And I'm sure as history starts digging out more, we start translating more, we'll see even more connections to indigenous cultures everywhere.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's so interesting how that pops up in different cultures everywhere, like that innate human wisdom and different manifestations all over the place. And a lot of this has been made more popular. Like we saw it, you know, in the Olympics several years ago, we started to see it like with volleyball players, they were all like taped up in a weird way. And we're like, what the hell is that? We start to learn about some of these techniques. It looks, when somebody has had this done, it looks like it was quite painful because there's those round kind of spots that you see after somebody's had it done.
Yeah. For lack of a better term, it's a perfectly circular hickey. That's exactly what it is, right? We're creating a negative pressure, which is breaking the superficial capillaries. And I will say, like, you know, I talk about this in the book, right? You'll go on to social media and you'll see a practitioner like me post a chart that says, oh, if it's this color, it means this. If it's this color, it means this. And I that's not wrong, but it's not a complete view, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to depend, right? Why were Michael Phelps's bruises so dark? Why? Because his trainer put the cups on the second he jumped out of the water. He's got blood pumping through his body at a rate that's so quick. That's why they're so dark, right? You know, he's also working out like a fiend, so he probably has a lot more lactic acid and a lot more, you know. So if you don't bruise, that doesn't mean it doesn't work. It's really about creating that space. If you bruise worse, it doesn't mean it's a better treatment or a worse treatment. It's just what happens, you know. So we can say, oh, it's because there's more stagnation in this area. And that's plausible. That might be one reason, but it could be that you have better circulation in that area than somebody else, or you have weaker capillaries than somebody else. So it's not right or wrong. It's just that there's more than one reason. And really, it should be, relief based on, you know, if you got no bruises, but you feel better, great, great treatment. If you got a ton of bruises and didn't do anything, well, what was the point?
Yeah.
You know, so you can take your shirt off at the gym and look at what I got done. It's been a great business card for me. I'm not going to lie. Where'd you get that done? Off the street, you know? Okay.
That's funny. In the book, you write about different techniques as well. Like, what are some of the different techniques? Could you describe that?
So, you know, I would say leave the fire cupping, which is where we use fire to actually create the vacuum, to the professionals. We go through and discuss the major types of different cups, right? So there's a whole bunch of ways to get the suction now, right? There's even mechanical pumps that like you press a button and the thing sucks the air out for you. There's hand pumps, there's twist on ones, and there's a lot of silicone ones that you actually just squish against the skin, push the air out. Now there's two main styles we talk about cupping in the book. One, the first one is static, where, hey, the shoulder hurts, I'm going to put a bunch of cups around the shoulder, let them sit, right? They're not moving. The other one is sliding cupping. Now, for sliding cupping, you put some oil down. You don't put the cup on as strong. And what we're trying to do is kind of scrape that cup against the skin. So it has to have some give. You need the oil or else you're going to tear somebody up. But it works better for the broader muscles. So up and down the spine, across the hips, down a shorter arm or length or something like that. It tends to be really good to combine the cupping therapy with kind of like a manual therapy.
Interesting. If somebody wanted to do this at home, could they screw themselves up pretty good? Like, is it recommended to work with a professional at least at first?
So this is one of the topics, right, that I talk about a little bit in the book, because I want people to understand that it's a safe technique, right? You can screw anything up, and I'm sure there's a reason or something that I'm not thinking of. Leaving the cups on way too long is going to be the biggest issue. In most cases, like, my office sells two different types of suction silicone cups. And part of the reason is, even if you went over 15 minutes, 20 minutes, you're probably not going to hurt yourself. So the idea was to give you a therapeutic dose without hurting you, right? It's like the over-the-counter Advil might only be 200 milligrams. The doc can write you a script for 800, 1,000, right? And that technically you could just take four of the over-the-counter ones, but you wouldn't want to do that without some supervision. So really, we talk about shorter treatment times. We talk about erring on the side of caution in the book, because I'd rather have you put the cup on, go, oh, that doesn't feel like it did enough, and then put it back on, rather than leave it on for 2 hours and go, why do I have this giant purple bruise that isn't going away?
Yeah.
So in most cases, you should be safe if you follow some certain rules. You don't want to put it on broken skin, if you have a skin lesion or something like that. Pregnant women, I say, please avoid it. We don't have any data really on that. It would be unethical to try and study that. I know some pregnant women that have had cupping while they were pregnant. I do not recommend it. But other than that, deep vein thrombosis and some big varicose veins, you would avoid those. But for most people, cupping should be safe.
Okay. Mostly like common sense stuff, which unfortunately is not as common as we would hope. But
believe me, there's a giant... giant disclaimer at the front of the book.
Smart.
Do I think anybody really could mess themselves up bad? No. You want to put one on your face for an hour, you're going to have a weird looking bruise on your face for 2 weeks. Probably not going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, I see. I mean, I similar to what we mentioned about you in the introduction with kettlebells, it's like, kettlebells should be fairly safe if you're moving correctly. It might be a good thing to hire somebody so they can show you that. And you probably don't want to start out with heavy overhead kettlebell snatches or whatever before you learn some basic techniques and things like that. And you did mention that you sell two of the silicone suction ones. Is that the one that you recommend the most?
So it's the one I use in the demo photos. There's a few big bonuses with those, right? They may not get as strong as some of the others. There's one that has a pump, like gun, that you can pump with. That one you can actually, my father actually gave himself blood blisters with that. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this podcast. Wow. But, I said, Dad, it says only 3 or 4 pumps. And I said, well, what did you do? Because he shows me this bruise with a whole bunch of blood blisters in it. And he goes, well, it felt really good when it was on. So I had your mom pump it a few more times. And then I said, yeah, but that's not... you could have left it a few more minutes rather than kept pumping it harder. But in most cases, you can't do that with the silicone ones. And some of the silicone ones have a handle that makes it nice to slide for sliding cupping. So that's why I prefer those. The other thing is they're real easy to clean. Silicone's non-porous. For home use, you might want to wipe them out with some Lysol wipes or something. Even if you went with the heavy duty stuff that we use in our clinic, that's called Cavicide, that you need to wear gloves to clean stuff with, you're not going to degrade the silicone too quickly. Some of the plastic cups, you wash them too much, you run them through the dishwasher, which I don't recommend, but some people do run them through the dishwasher. the plastic is not sturdy enough. It's going to degrade over time.
Yeah, I see. Okay. And then one thing that confuses people, like when my wife is working on somebody, they might be complaining about pain in their right shoulder. And she'll say like, okay, well, based on the way I just watched you move, let's do some techniques on your left hip. And people are like, what the hell are you talking about? I said it hurts here. Is cupping local to where you have pain?
It's a little bit more, it's a little bit more point and shoot. You do want to look at the area as a whole thing. Absolutely. In acupuncture, we do the same thing. Left shoulder, right hip, right knee, left elbow, that kind of thing. And we're trying to look at everything as a whole system with cupping. And once again, because this evolved as kind of a folk medicine, it can be a little bit more like, oh, it hurts here. Let's check around that whole area, make sure we're working and covering everything. I do like distal points, even with some of these silicone cups. And another advantage of them is they come in very small sizes. So sometimes you can put them like, I might be having some shoulder pain, but I notice these really tight spots on the forearm. Let me get those too. Right. So now we're treating more in a global way that we would with acupuncture, where we're doing some local, but some distal.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. What other questions does my ignorance prevent me from asking you about cupping?
I don't know. I think you hit them pretty well. I think you'll find some textbooks that are very erudite. They're written for like PTs and people with like this vast anatomy knowledge base. And that's not how the practice started. And there's nothing against that. Please, if you're into it, please buy those books. If you're a professional, read those books. But what this book is meant to be is the down and dirty. What do I need to know? What would grandma have taught you? And how do I do this effectively for a bunch of different things and be able to treat, my kids, my family, my friends, myself, within a short little read? So, I mean, the book's 131 pages long. It's not meant to be the Iliad or the Odyssey or Ivanhoe. I'll name just some thick books.
Well, that's fantastic. I appreciate the practicality of that and going through your content. That really shines through. I love how you're kind of democratizing things and making it easy for people. I think we both know there's so many podcasters and influencers and all these guys who are getting into all of these techniques that you and I probably love. We both have saunas. Like I get in my sauna every single day. They develop these protocols that end up being very complicated and technical. And the more you dig down into how they came up with that, the less and less like science there is. It's just more like this person is making something up and then is pitching it in this way that you feel like you need to buy certain things or get the program or do this protocol exactly the way this guy says and take the 45 supplements a day kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's really disingenuous.
Well, I think that's what happens when we have until capitalism falls, we're not going to have a different system, So these people are trying to make a living and I can't fault them for that. But at the same token, I don't think they're vetting everything as well as they should. Right. I'll see people post about meditation and they're using, and I'm like, look, here's my Muse headband. I love this thing. I've been using it since 2017. It's got miles of research on it. NASA uses it. MIT uses it. Harvard uses it. I'm an ambassador for them. I don't throw my promo code around. Why? Because I've got over 5 years of daily meditation on this device alone. And I've been meditating for longer than that. It didn't exist when I started. But it keeps me tracked. Keeps me accountable for meditating. And within that, it's my favorite biohacking device. And do you need it to meditate? No, you absolutely need nothing for meditation. And like we were saying before, do you need a cold plunge to do a cold therapy? Not if you live in a climate that has seasons. Not if you're near a cold river. Even in August, if you go up, if you're in the mountains, those freaking rivers are cold. Anything colder than 60 degrees, you're getting cold exposure.
Yep.
So it's interesting. I mean, at our office, we do stacking. We try to combine things in an intelligent way. Like, oh, somebody's coming in for pain. What do we got that really helps? Oh, somebody's coming in for sinus issues. How do we do this intelligently to get them the most synergistic effect. But do we have research on these combinations? No, because I have research on the individual stuff. I know theoretically it should work better together. And I think that's what a lot of these influencers are doing. But I think the other thing is there's so many devices. And I love gadgets, man. I got a bucket right here. But at the same time, is it really that good? Is it really doing what it says it is? You can't trust the company that publishes the study on their own equipment. And why? Because like data is going to get excluded and, you know, oh, we're only focusing on this one thing. Or why did you only study it in like this exact type of person? Like, does it not work in the other people? We say, oh, there's a study, and then all of a sudden we go, oh yeah, that's exciting. I do it too. I'm like, oh, it's only $8,000. Yeah, maybe my clinic needs that. And I'm like, wait, hold on. The study isn't saying what you're claiming, or hey, this is only in rats.
So
I see the need to do that experimentation on yourself, but unless somebody's picking up the bill, I don't want to take the big swings anymore. You know, I don't want to go like, let's do this, you know?
Good point. On the note of the headband, like I just repurchased the Calm app to do the daily Calm meditation every single day.
It's good stuff.
Is this like being in India and learning meditation from the gods? No, but I had let my meditation slip. And by seeing a number of my streaks, that motivates me to keep doing it. And it's better today than it was yesterday than it was a week ago when I got it. So you do what you gotta
do. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. And whatever works for you is kind of the point there, right? Whatever's going to hold you accountable and make you do that and form that habit, right?
Yep.
I think that's important.
Okay, awesome. I do want to talk just briefly about the, you know, the cold plunge and the sauna and the infrared and all that stuff. You guys practice so many different modalities, and I love that you do the stacking and you find whatever's going to work best for that person. You don't have exact studies on this kind of stuff, so the best thing you can do is N of one experimentation, see how this works for the person. You can always change it up. What are some of your other favorite things to do with people?
So outside of acupuncture and Chinese medicine, one of the things we like to do is the contrast therapy. That seems to be the one that people are really lit up about now. So we have a couple of different ways of doing it. Our whole body cryotherapy, you need to be dry in it. So no sweat, no moisture. So if you're going to do our hot, cold, or cold, hot, cold, we put you in the cryotherapy first. You'll do the sauna and then you'll get into the cold plunge. And that one really, you're getting this kind of artificial pump. Everything's constricting, everything's opening up, everything's constricting again. So we're really flushing the tissue out, right? We have some people that do our unlimited membership and they do that like 3 to 4 times a week. And they just, that's what they're there for. You know, they know they're going to be at the office, you know, maybe an hour and a half. And, you know, chronic illness, And I don't talk about weight loss because I feel like that's such a slippery slope. But a lot of them are seeing like, not only am I feeling better, I look different, I have more energy, and that's probably our most popular stack right now to be able to do that. We have had some people do some hot, cold, hot. They tend not to want to go. Like after the cold, they're excited to go in the hot, but that's almost like if they wanted to do our infrared sauna for that long, it's kind of like a longer protocol.
Yeah.
So it's time dependent. It's how can we get you the biggest bang for your buck the quickest we can. Another stack I really like is we have exercise with oxygen therapy. We used to have a hyperbaric chamber, which takes about an hour. The EWAT system is about a 15-minute protocol. So we flood your body with excess oxygen that's going to be in the serum, right? You can't get more oxygen on the red blood cells than 100%, but you can stockpile it into the liquid part of the blood. Oxygen is needed for your mitochondria to make more ATP. We know that red light stimulates your mitochondria to make more ATP. So what we do is we put you on the exercise with oxygen therapy bike. You stockpile a bunch of oxygen in your tissue. You get on the red light therapy and you have more cellular energy being kicked out because you have an abundance of oxygen and you're getting those cells stimulated to make it.
Fascinating.
Which is super cool to me.
That reminds me of what they were doing this here in preparation for the 2002 Olympics here just outside of the Salt Lake Valley. We're at 4,500 feet. And you know, the oval is just right down the street. It's 10 or 15 minutes away. They would have the speed skaters train with oxygen so that they could have a higher power output. And then as soon as they're done, it's like the phrase in endurance training is train low, live high. Sounds like a similar thing where you're training the
it really is, you know, and I often describe exercise with oxygen therapy is legal blood doping because that's not adding more blood cells. But what I'm doing is like you have, I don't want to say an infinite capacity, but a very high capacity to hold oxygen in the liquid part of your blood. Now, studies from the company that we use, LiveO2, it show that you actually have to actively work to get that into your system. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason that we changed from a hyperbaric, you know, it was a home unit because that's all practitioners like me can get because the hard chambers require pure oxygen certifications and you need a hospital basically to have that kind of setup. But with this, it was about a 15-foot dive is what we would call it. And you have about 30% more serum oxygen for about 3 hours after the treatment, but you had to be in there an hour. So people that had traumatic brain injury, people that had autism, and these are a lot of off-label uses that people would use them for, would need to be in that chamber 6 to 7 days a week for an hour. And at that point, financially, time-wise, it makes more sense for people to rent one and have it at home. If I could tell you that I can get you like 400% more serum oxygen in 15 to 20 minutes, and that'll last for 3 days, which is what LiveO2 is claiming, and it takes 15 minutes, you can come in and ride a bike for 15 minutes twice a week.
Yeah.
Right. So we have people doing that and they really get some great benefits out of it.
Cool.
And with that, like that oxygen's lasting 3 days a week. So we get a lot of boxers that come in. Baltimore's a big boxing town. There's a lot of gyms. They would use it and they'd love it. You know, they'd go weigh in, they'd come, they'd sit on the bike, you know, that now they're doped up and they're ready for the fight. You know, they got extra oxygen.
Yeah. Wow. So fascinating. Okay. So obviously what you were doing is very unique. You have a whole different background with the acupuncture and the Eastern medicine. I am noticing that a lot more of the kind of like box style recovery centers are popping up. Some of them do have cryo. Some of them do have cold plunges.
Yeah.
Not many have both. Do you have a preference one over the other, or to you, is it just like pretty much whatever you can do is great?
So I, you know, we wanted to be more accessible to everyone, you know, and I'll mention this too. Everything we added wasn't because we saw a trend. It was because it does something that East Asian medicine does from a different route, right? So acupuncture, like I mentioned before, huge reducing inflammation. Well, so does cryotherapy. Well, the salt therapy does it for the lungs and the airways. Well, the oxygen therapy does it, right? It gets more nourishment to the tissue. The red light therapy stimulates mitochondria. Well, acupuncture moxibustion does that. We didn't even talk about moxibustion, but don't worry about that. That stimulates the mitochondria as well. So it had to make sense from an East Asian medicine standpoint. The other thing, and I'm not going to knock big chains because they've got a lot of money. There's one down the street from me. They're not practitioner driven, right? So you go in and you probably have some teenager, and look, I'm not knocking teenagers, running you through the cryo, and it's they're doing it because it's a piece of spa equipment, you know. It like there are no regulations with it. Our unit is a grade 3 medical device in Europe. It's actually covered by some European insurance companies.
Wow.
You know, with the idea of how do we have the biggest therapeutic effect? So it wasn't just a let me knock in here and do some quick recovery. There also doesn't seem to be with a lot of these boxes, and I know of two that I can name. there isn't an intelligence to how they want you to do this stuff.
I see.
We're going to give you X number of points a month. Come and spend them however you want. You know, Mobile IV, we have a company that comes in and does IVs at our office, because that seems to be another big thing too. While we love having them there, and they're pretty busy at our place, our goal is what can we do to your body that we don't have to add external things in. So when they come in to supplement, I think that's it's being used a little bit more conservatively. right? Oh, we've tried all this. Let's make sure you get that too.
I see. Man, Tom, this has been an amazing conversation. I feel like we could talk for hours and hours. I really, really appreciate your passion and your energy to be able to share some of this stuff today. Where would you like people to go to find you and connect with you and your work?
So Charm City Integrate Tive, TIVE.com is my website. It'll link to my cupping book called thecuppingbook.com. You'll find out about me if people want me to come out and lecture, or I'm even doing some consulting where I help people set up centers like mine. I really want to make this as accessible and as commonplace as possible. You don't want everything to, oh God, that's so mainstream. But no, I want people to feel better. And the more people that know about this, the better people are going to feel.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Dr. Tommy Jr., thank you again so very much for everything that you've done. I love this fusion of all of these different techniques. Not one thing is like ruled out or put above another. They're just all kinds of tools and the way you're customizing this to help people. And again, democratizing this for the everyday bum like me. I really, really appreciate the information you're bringing in and the content that you're creating. So thank you so very much for everything that you do. And thank you for coming on our show today. I hope this will not be the last time.
I hope so too, man. I had a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure to host you. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. Thank you so very much for listening to and supporting Boundless Body Radio. This podcast is such a passion of mine, one of my favorite parts about running our business, and none of this would be possible without our incredible guests and listeners like yourself. Thank you so, so very much for all of the amazing reviews that we get on Apple and Spotify. Trust me, we read them all, and it means the world to hear that you are enjoying the show as well. I am very excited to announce that this summer, I will be hosting a nutrition seminar series. This is actually a project that I started after I became certified as a nutrition coach. I wanted to get a group of people together to discuss all aspects of human nutrition. And as a bonus, I did the whole thing outside by a pool, which was great. After the pandemic, I stopped hosting the series, but this year I've decided to bring it back. Each week, we'll have a particular topic and an agenda. We'll have outlines that include references and also meal plans, guest appearances, book giveaways, and more, all for free. For those of you who live in the Salt Lake City area, the seminars will be hosted every Tuesday at noon, starting on May 28th, and will run all the way until September 3rd. The seminar will be hosted outside, of course, at the beautiful Bowery Park in Daybreak, where I live. If you're available and in the area, we would absolutely love to see you there. If you are unable to attend, either that day and time does not work for you, or you don't live in the area, good news for you as well, we are going to put all the recordings and post them on YouTube, where you can submit listener questions in the comment section, which we can address in future seminars. I'm also including all of the seminar materials on our website, so you don't have to miss out on the content. My goal is to make a comprehensive yet simple understanding of nutrition so that anybody confused about how they should eat can create a framework for themselves based on their individual goals. As I said, if you're interested in participating, we'd love to have you. If you can't make it into the in-person seminar, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and also our website at myboundlessbody.com/seminar to find all the resources, videos, and a fun quiz. Either way, thank you as always for listening to Boundless Body Radio.